so.
Might say I've started recording because I've already feel like we've got onto a good chat. So I'm going to just sort of introduce this very quickly. I've already started because I thought we were onto a good point. So I'm a little bit buzzing right now for this podcast because on the other side of the line is Phil White, who, if you know anything about bicycle design in the last 20 years, you'll recognize that name. And that's a pretty good way of summing it up, I think. So you are one of the founders of Cervelo, started back in 1995. We've just been chatting a bit before I've started recording about bikes, track racing. I was just saying I've just purchased a T1. And then we started talking about the Isle of Man. My dad actually has raced the TT. I would have started recording.
That's amazing. That is utter insanity, but it's so cool.
So he it's a beautiful place. Like I can't honestly, like I mean I'm a bit biased, but it is a beautiful island. My dad used to be world sidecar champ, British superbike champ, and British superbike champ in like 83, something like that, 1983. But he's a bit of a rebel. Like, he used to look like James Hunt, so he had like long blonde hair, and he was regularly mistaken for James Hunt when he was younger. But the bit that's like funny is like you talk to him about racing like the TT and stuff, and like he used to do it on a motorbike. He used to do it 1000cc Aprilia, and he used to do it on sidecars as well. And he's quite a tiny man. He's like 5'5", so he's on these massive bikes, and he's a little guy. Like, and the Aprilias like sound like Lancaster, like massive, like powerful engines, like really deep, like burrow to them and everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was talking to him because it's Father's Day in Europe. It was over the weekend, and I was talking to him on the phone, and we were just chatting about bikes, as you do. He's just bought himself an e-bike, which is pretty cool. But anyway, when he used to race in the sidecars. I was looking at old photos of him, and he was wearing Converse trainers.
So he wasn't the pilot. He was the
passenger.
Passenger.
Yeah.
Just jumping over the other guy.
Apparently it was known as like suicide position.
Well, yeah, because you're sticking your head farther out, closer to the wall than the pilot, and you got nothing in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. Like. And one of the guys he used to race with, I can't remember his surname, but his first name was Gary, had a reputation of like seriously hurting his passengers. But anyway, my dad was like, I was like, why did you wear Converse? Or he calls them basketball shoes. Baseball shoes, sorry. I was like, why were you wearing Converse and stuff? And he was like, well, I could have worn leather boots, but they just weren't very flexible, and Converse were way more comfortable, so I just wore them. And I was like, you know, if you crashed, you'd lose your feet. And he was like, yeah, I'm 60 now, and I didn't really crash then, so it's all right. I was just like,
I think if you crash on a sidecar at the Isle of Man, it doesn't really matter what boots you're wearing.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to do more damage, aren't you?
Yeah.
He's Matt. He's literally, I know where I get my like sort of
crazy streak.
It's definitely from him, 100%. Anyway, how are you?
Very good, thanks. Suffering through I'm not really suffering through the lockdown because we've been kind of lucky over here in that we haven't ever been restricted from like you can't go out and ride. So, it initially gave me a bit more time to ride my bike, and and then I got involved in with the whole COVID thing. It was just like, well, how do we help out the company? So I was on the board and kind of, I think it was a case of many boards. Everyone just rolled up their sleeves and dove in wherever they thought they could help. So some people on finding new financing, some people on investment, and I had more the operational side from my background. So we kind of just jumped in there, but yeah, I've had a pretty good, I live close to the edge of the city, so it's not too hard to get out and go riding, but I really pity people that have been you know, shuttered in a condo downtown with two kids and a dog and 800 square feet or something like that. It'd be just like, that would be suicidal.
Yeah. So whereabouts are you?
In the west side of Toronto.
Oh, man. I love Toronto. I do.
It's pretty good. The only thing is it's flat. So it's there's one hill that kind of goes from here to Niagara Falls, where the end of the old lake used to be a millennia ago. But that's the one hill. And so, we're as bad as the Dutch, you know, like we're not known as great climbers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so I used to, as I said before I started recording, I worked in architecture and I worked for, ironically, an Australian company, but I did work in Canada. And Toronto was, I did a lot of projects in Toronto. Two in Toronto, two in Montreal, and one somewhere else. I can't remember where it was now. But the Toronto one was Deloitte's headquarters.
Oh, yeah. Downtown, right? Right downtown, right?
Yeah. I think it finished like 3 or 4 years ago, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to fly out there quite a lot. And it's just a really nice place.
It's pretty good. Like, I mean, I don't think you really appreciate it when you live in, but. But yeah, I have no major complaints. It works out pretty well. So
yeah, yeah. The only thing that I will say is when it's cold, it's really, really cold.
Well, you know, when I met Gerard and we were both going to McGill, that was in Montreal, and McGill's about another Montreal's about another 5 or 7 degrees, 7 Celsius degrees colder than Toronto. So you really notice that. I mean, you think 5 degrees, how much is that? Well, it's enough that you really notice it. So
definitely. I mean, the problem I had was I was going from Perth or Melbourne to Canada. Oof. And like that's two suitcases of the complete opposite temperature range.
Yeah, that's true.
and it was like, it was hard. It was really hard. Anyway, so as I said, anyone who knows much about bikes would recognize your name because it was written on the rear stays of a load of Cervelos.
Yep. But
that's how I first knew your name, to be honest with you. And that, as for me, as a cyclist and a fan of cycling as a sport, it's been like watching how... You know, I'm 30, which is kind of scary to say, but I am 30. And like seeing how, the involvement that you guys had in kind of, I almost would say, maybe redefining what a racing bike was. With the Soloist. Like that was such an iconic bike when it came out. Obviously, you probably had these conversations a million and one times, I'm sure. But like for me, it's like fascinating to be able to hear from you like more directly how and why you wanted to do something so different. Like everything back then, I guess, was when you guys were starting, it was kind of very simple tubing. You didn't really have any of the aerodynamic thoughts into it, I guess. I mean, 95, yeah. I was in 6.
Yeah. I mean, when we started, we didn't really said, hey, we're going to do something different or anything. We just, the science had been out there for a long time. The Americans had, you know, had aero bikes in like 84 at the Olympics. And there was a lot of science written about it, but there was really no one had actually commercialized anything. So when we started, every team out there in the world tour, was riding pretty much a round tube, steel bike. Mostly Italian, French, or British made. The tubing was really, you know, predominantly Columbus. There was a bit of Excel and some Reynolds, but, you know, not much else. And the science was well out there. And we said, well, why don't we just make something that's more aero? Like, that's what's going to make you faster. And surely, if you're riding, you know, you're an athlete at this sort of level, you would want to be faster. I mean, that's going to make you win more. It's like, why wouldn't anyone do this? It's
a no-brainer, isn't it?
Yeah, totally no-brainer. What we hadn't counted on was the cycling industry is very, very traditional. It wasn't well received in cycling. It was like, oh, that's kind of weird. And we go, yeah, but who cares if it's weird? It's faster. And they go, oh yeah, but I don't like that. I don't really want to ride that. Even pros, and that's what we were shocked by. Now the people that were most interested in it and were willing to try it were either people that were specialized in time trials. So early on, we got Hanke Kupfernagel on and Erik Wolberg, who was the Canadian national champion and Pan Am champion. There was no selling them. It's like, it's faster, I'll ride it. And then triathletes. And the triathletes had this crazy reputation of riding anything. And they did ride some pretty crazy stuff. But it was like they were willing to try anything. Whereas, you know, there was an argument that the cyclists weren't willing to try anything. So we found early on that we got started with a lot of support from Jenny Bunyo's MG Techno Gym team. They basically gave us a lot of equipment and funded a bunch of our early work for them. The people we actually said ended up selling everything to were triathletes.
I mean, you're right. I'm definitely not a triathlete. I can't run. I can swim. I can't run. But you do. I mean, you look at like triathlon bikes when you see like the Beam bikes, and just there's much more like people are literally going out there for the marginal gains, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I guess like in the UK, like time trialing is a big thing in the UK. We've got a really big history of it, and because like I think we're quite unique in the sense that time trialing's governed separately from road cycling and road racing, so you could technically race on a triathlon design bike in a TT in the UK. And it's not really like people just don't think about it because you're all about just going faster, faster, faster all the time. Like I do a lot of time trialing myself. But I do 24 hours as opposed to 10 miles. And it's the same thing. It's like, you just try and find any hack, any gain you can to get as fast as possible, whether that's like, you know, to do with your kit that you're wearing or the bike itself. Like, it's I find that side of it really fascinating, and it surprises me to hear that there wasn't that much of a, like, a lot of road cyclists were quite sort of turned off by it at first. But equally, as you do say, that it's road cycling is a bit weird and clicky and a bit, as you say, traditionalist at points, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's changed over the last, you know, what was it? I guess it's 25 years since we started, and that makes me feel old. But yeah, I mean, it's changed now. I mean, you look at now, every race bike on every team is an aero carbon bike. So, yeah, I think we started something, or, you know, it was the right time. The industry was, or the market was ready for it. The industry wasn't really, but the market was ready to consider it. Although on the initial teams, like Bjørn Riis, you know, when he told the team that he'd signed this contract with us, because he was always about the marginal gains, and that's the same philosophy he took to his team, was finding any opportunity. And and the feedback from the several people on the team was, oh, that's just freaking weird, and it's ugly, and I'm not riding it. And he said, well, you know, this is what you got to ride, and I run this team, so you're going to ride it, or you don't work here. See you later. And that was the sort of person that you needed to, I think that's the role of a team leader, is like, you know, I found the best equipment, I've done my side of it, you're now going to ride it. And you don't leave it up to riders to pick their equipment. Like, they don't have that expertise, and you're not paying them for that. You're paying them to push the pedals really hard and go to that pain envelope where, you know, most people can't. So, you know, let the Bjørn Riises of the world, and let the team managers find the best equipment for you and tell you why it's the best equipment, and just use it and do your best with it.
Yeah. I mean, you look at some of the, like, the caliber of riders in the past and present who have ridden on Cervelo bikes. You know, you've had Cancellara, David Miller, Lizzie Armistead, Mark Cavendish. Like, the list is just, could go on and on and on with the riders that have ridden it. And like, I mean, that's amazing in its own right. And same on the triathlon side of it. Is there any like, particular moments at your time that you're most proud of when you've seen certain riders on something you've designed?
I guess there's a bunch. I mean, winning the Tour and the Giro are pretty special, and we've done that, you know, both on the men's and the women's side. You know, having the test team, I think was really special. I mean, because we spent a lot more time with the riders, you know, both from a standpoint of investing in making them faster. But also we had the positive side of having them with us. And so we generally had like training camps. We'd have the men and women together. And, you know, so yeah, I remember Lizzie and, a bunch of the other athletes. Emma Pooley was always one that struck me once because I went riding with her and the team one time and she was in front of me and she's so tiny that you get no draft at all off of her. And she's so strong that you just cracks me.
Yeah.
But
her riding back. She's nuts, isn't she?
Yeah. So yeah. I think actually some of the best memories I've had are with the women's team. They were super helpful on what they could do for us as a sponsor. And they were really went to the wall for us. The men were also great. I mean, Sastre was just an incredible guy and still also remember, Thor, quiet, but a great leader. That was the thing with the test team is we had guys that were great leaders and they were able to bring their values to the team and, you know, everyone sucked it up and believed they had the best equipment and the best team. And that showed in the results they got. You know, they went from being, you know, an unranked team to being number one in the world in 6 months. So yeah, it was a really fun time. I think one of the other things that I would say, there's one more thing that was pretty cool for me. And that was Ryder Hegdahl winning the Giro. Because that was, you know, a Canadian winning the first, the first Grand Tour for Canada on a Canadian bike. So that's kind of maybe not going to excite your readers as much or listeners.
Yeah.
But for me, that was pretty cool.
I mean, it was pretty cool, I think, for a lot of people to see because he wasn't necessarily, I wouldn't say maybe picked for favorite.
Yeah.
So like, it's always nice when someone who you maybe don't quite expect to do as well smashes it. Yeah. Over here in the UK, they've actually been playing loads of the old, on the TV, they've been playing loads of the old Giro stages and quite a lot of races with him have come up, which has been, for me, is like kind of cool to watch. And like, also like, I've always been like a big fan of like David Miller as a Brit. And I know obviously he got done for doping, but I have a lot of respect for how he's kind of dealt with that situation and how that all kind of, you know, obviously it's a very controversial topic. It's one I don't feel like we need to particularly go into, but like the way that he came out of it and like sort of like spoke about it very openly and honestly and sort of broke up his life into, you know, he's now got chapter 3 with his clothing brand saying that's his third chapter of his life. But as a youngster, like he was always like the rider that I was like, yeah, God, he's really cool.
Yeah. There's some great, skipping back, there is a great video of Ryder in Rome on that bike, on the TT bike. And it's a great one to look at bike handling because he has that bike arguably over the edge, certainly on the edge. It's bouncing around corners. I mean, that's one of the best time trials I've ever seen on anyone. How fast and how he's got that bike on the edge.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, I can imagine how proud it must have made you feel that, especially having Ryder doing that on a Canadian bike at one of the biggest races in the world. Like,
it was cool.
So what, in your time at Cervelo, what was probably one of the bikes you were most proud of that you ever got involved with?
You know, I keep, people always ask me that, of course. But I think, you know, the thing that I'm, and I didn't realize this until I left Cervelo and kind of went to work in the other pawn companies. I think the thing that I was most proud of was actually the culture of innovation we created. So it wasn't actually a product. It was just a way of thinking and a way of doing that the engineers and the whole company kind of came together with this goal of making our riders faster. That was our mission statement initially. And they just internalized that. And it was one of those things where, you know, you know your mission statement sinks in and people have absorbed it when they recite it unprompted. It's like, we said, like, well, what do you guys think we should do? And they would go back to that and go, well, our goal is to make riders faster. So, you know, I guess we should do this. It's like, yeah, you should do that. And so I think that was the thing that I think I'm kind of most proud of. I mean, the bikes were super fun. But I mean, I had no idea how strong the culture was and how important culture was, until I left, until I saw it, you know, saw other companies and started doing some consulting after leaving Pond, and you go, oh yeah, it really works. I mean, there's a great line by, what's the guy that ran Southwest Airlines? And he said, culture eats strategy for lunch. and it's like, yeah, you start to understand, you know, just how important that is and how valuable it is. So I think that's kind of, now I'm trying to, you know, help other companies with that as I've kind of gone forward, because I really like the innovation side and I like seeing just people get it and just roll with it and kind of internalize it. So that's super fun for me.
Yeah, nice. I did a podcast with a couple of, one of the engineers at Civelle, and he was saying that there's still this very much this character of, like, you know, everyone goes out for a ride together, everyone like gets like the old like R3s and stretches them and widens them for bigger tires, like when the mud edition ones came out, all that kind of thing. And he's like, yeah, we, you know, we've all got this, like, it's very much like a, everyone understands why they're there and what they're doing. And I think it comes very still to this day that, you know, there's definitely a massive influence that you guys had from day one, and it will always be kind of integrated into the brand, which is awesome. Really, really cool. I bet this is also another question that you get asked a million times. I'm going to apologize in advance, but I'm going to ask still, how the hell do you design a bike?
Well, that's a really good question, because, you know, you see a lot of times where, you know, people, not necessarily in bikes, but in anything, where people are getting close to the launch and they're going, no, that's not what we're doing. This is what we're doing. Or, you know, that's a stupid thing. What do we do that for? And it's like, well, I mean, and I've seen this in a bunch of places, and what it comes down to is really a lack of clarity when you start. You start with this idea, okay, what do you see out there? What's the background for, what's happening in the environment? And then you go, and what are we trying to do to overcome that? We need a bike that does this, or we need a product that does this. And if there's that clarity, and that really comes from a charter or, you know, there's a bunch of different words for it. But if you start off with that goal and it's really clear, like, it takes some time to get that clarity. But when you get that clarity and you've got it down in like one sentence, then you got it nailed. Because then everyone looks back the same way they do from a culture standpoint and says, why does Civelle exist? We exist to make riders faster. What does this bike exist? This bike exists for the fastest gravel racing bike out there. Maybe that's what you're looking for. Or maybe it's the most enjoyable gravel racing bike out there. Well, then you got to define enjoyable, but, you know, at least you're kind of getting there. So yeah. I think a lot of it comes down to a very clear goal when you're starting. That's the trick.
Nice. That's like, you know, when you, I have like a mentor who, he taught me when I studied architecture. He's a guy called Leighton Reed. He's like, he's quite old school, but he was he is like quite a well-known architect in the UK. And that's one of the things he always would refer to me, is like clarity, is knowing exactly, basically having like a mission statement, being clear to it and being loyal to it. And like what we used to do when we were studying and stuff, he's like, you'd write this like mission statement effectively on a wall in front of you, so you'd always look at it and always use it as your reference point. And, and that's how you end up answering the kind of question that you're trying to do, I guess. It's like, yeah, I mean, bike design, there's so many different bikes out there now, like the diversity of, or different types of riding, isn't there? Like, and it seems like we're coming up with a new type of riding every year nearly, which is, it's not anything that's new. Like, there's always been gravel roads, there's always been mountain bike trails. You know, it's nothing new. It's just like there's everyone keeps redefining things, which is kind of fine. Like the more people that get into cycling, the better. Like there was something that came out in the UK today that during this like COVID-19 lockdown, they were saying that there's been I think it was 1.3 million bikes sold in like the lockdown period, like the month and a half of proper lockdown.
Wow.
Which is nuts. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Over here in North America, the discussion is like, you know, we went through a couple of bike booms. The big one was post, I guess, the oil crisis in the early 70s. And then there was the mountain bike boom. And of course, they typically fizzle out. But is this one the one that'll keep it going? You know, with e-bikes as well, especially over here where you've got longer distances to commute. And I just can't see, you know, people jumping back on transit quickly. So it may create the awareness of cycling, the fact that it's more more available. We've built a lot of you know, protected bike lanes, and I know we've got e-bikes. I hope this is the one that kind of tips it over, and cycling really stays as a viable transit mode in North America. So cross your fingers. This could be it.
It could be. I mean, it's in the UK. Like, we definitely don't have the same kind of, like, I guess, history. And, like, you know, like you go to like the Netherlands or Belgium and or France or Italy, any of them, it's like part of the culture, isn't it? And like the UK doesn't have that yet. And I don't think like North America quite has that as well yet. But it feels like we're all getting there, which is definitely a positive thing. Like, I actually, you know, my attitude is very much like the more people riding, the better it is for everyone, because we're doing less harm to the environment and the roads become safer. Really simple.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you're now heading up 4i, 4iiii,
yep,
however we want to say it. That's quite, I mean, that's quite a change, no, from going from the engineering bikes to power meters. And so 4i, how, I mean, I personally, I've never used a 4i. I've always respected the brand from afar and seen like the trainers that's come out, and then you've got it all started with sort of like a single side and then went to dual sided power meters. I train with power, so I'm a sucker for it. Like, I'm kind of slightly obsessed with it, and having it as an extra metric, it's just that fact that it's like, you know, heart rate varies so easily and is so fluctuated, while power is like a real number.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's more, I mean, everyone says like, oh, you know, it's your FTP and all that is orientated around you. But like, you go into watts per kilo and you can kind of like understand it a bit more against someone else. Like, how, with power meters especially, like, that technology is clearly, it's grown a lot, I feel like, in the last like couple of years. Like, you know, when you started Cervelo, the power meters weren't really a thing, I guess. And now it's kind of become the be all and end all in world tour racing. Like, what's your opinion on that? Do you think that they should be using power meters in like the Grand Tours?
Yeah, I don't see, to be honest, I don't really see the problem with it personally. I mean, the power gives you one metric on your performance, but I remember seeing probably a year ago, they were looking at, you know, the effect of, you know, they were doing they were using a boxer, and they were saying, let's measure the force that he can put out just normally, like just sitting there, like I'm sitting there and I ask you to punch a punching bag. And it was an instrumented bag. Like, measure the force. And then they did that. And then they said, okay, let's see how it would work if we gave you some, you know, really crazy drug cocktail that made you super strong. And it was and he was up significantly higher. I think, I can't remember what the number was, maybe 30% or something. And then they said, okay, they said to his coach, okay, now just psych him out mentally. And like, just give him, make him believe he can do anything, whatever you would do. And he like more than doubled what he could do on with doping, and it was massive. I wish I had a copy of that show, but it just showed, like, I mean, doping isn't the be-all and the end-all, it's the head. And so when we look at here, where we've now hopefully kind of eliminated the doping out of it, but I mean, now everyone's worried, oh, you know, everyone's just playing to their power meters. Well, if you watch that thing all day and live and die by it, yeah, you're going to have, you're going to do no better than what it says you can do, but you know that you can do way better than what that number says. Like, you know, there's that always that line. It's how many minutes does a yellow jersey give you in the tour? It's like,
yeah.
If you play by your power, you're never going to get to a yellow jersey. So, yeah. And you're never going to win the tour. So I think you talk to these guys that are really good and they go, yeah, I don't look at that power when I have to go on climbing, you know, you're halfway up Ventoux and everyone goes in front of you. You don't go, oh, I can't go because I'm going to ruin my power strategy. It's like, so, you know, I think
a choice.
Yeah, you just look at it and go, yeah, clearly I have to up my FTP because I'm doing, you know, 50% more than what it says I can do.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a problem. And it is an amazing tool for improving your training. So I think that's where the principal benefit is. Like training with power, it's like no one that's serious would now, you know, talk about it any other way, really. So, yeah, I think that's a big step forward. And the thing is that, you know, they've come down so much in price. Like, I mean, was it 5 years ago, maybe more, they were like $5,000. And now, you know, we have a great power meter from $299 or like either pounds or US dollars, $299. That's spectacularly inexpensive, and it's a really, really good power meter. It's basically the same thing as being used, or it is the same thing as being used by the World Tour teams. So it's not a super high end, super complex tool anymore. It's something that's very accessible, at least from our standpoint, anyways.
I mean, that's one of the things I was going to ask you is, where do you feel the whole power meter market is going to be in like 5 years' time? Like, it's definitely, as you say, prices are dropping, which is amazing. Do you feel that that's going to be the way it's going to keep going? The prices are going to keep coming down?
I don't think they're going to keep coming down a whole lot more. I think that they'll continue to be cost effective. And I think, you know, that's for, you know, a single-sided and dual-sided are still a little bit more. So they'll come down over time a little bit more. But, you know, I think people are looking now for more information on kind of what that really provides them with help. So, you know, price is democratized. I'm looking for reliability. You know, now you've got our power meters are good for 3 years, included warranty. You know, you got the World Tour quality, so you know it'll last. So now it's like, okay, what else? I mean, there's other sensors. How else could this expand my understanding and ability to train and race better? So I think you're finding things coming together as a kind of an ecosystem. Like working with your smart trainer and your power meter, I think that's something that we're going to see more of over time. I mean, you can now either, if you've got a bike that's got a power meter on it, you can hook it up to your trainer. You can ride it on Zwift, especially with ours. If you've got a heart rate monitor, one of our heart rate monitors, you can pull in the Ant Plus data and the Bluetooth data and transmit it to your computer, so you can use it on Zwift. So it's a really cheap, smart trainer solution. Or, you know, if you've got a really nice smart trainer, you're looking now for, oh, how do I train in the winter, and then how do I take that out onto the road in the summer? And you know, you can do that because they're so inexpensive. So yeah, I think that's where we're going to see is more of an ecosystem of electronics, you know, that are helpful and enjoyable to you as a rider all year round.
Yeah, it's like, it's one of the things that I find really interesting about it is that it's a metric that really allows people to get fitter and faster. And a lot of people think it sounds really complex at first, but yeah, maybe it is quite complex at first, but I think it's quite easy to start to get your head around it. And as you say, we're starting to see so much more of like a virtual racing, especially with, you know, during the height of lockdown, like virtual racing was massive. Like, just, I think Zwift had like some stupid numbers of riders on it at points. And I'd imagine all the other sort of online platforms were very similar, but yeah, Zwift had like crazy numbers of riders on it. And then you have the like, the World Tour teams doing races on there, and the virtual cycling stuff is great. It's good fun to watch.
Yeah, and I'm finding the like Trainer Road, like I think they're way up as well. I mean, we've been finding that both Zwift and Trainer Road have been kind of trying to find solutions for people to get them kind of how's a cheap setup that I can get right now, because of course all the trainers sold out almost immediately. So it was how do you do a cheap smart trainer and get in the game? But also we're just finding more and more people are training more inside. Mm-hmm. So it was like, you couldn't go outside, you know, you didn't have a lot else to do. So, well, I might as well actually get fitter and enjoy it more. So yeah, I think I was seeing the big numbers jump up on either, you know, the less social side, more of the hardcore training sites, but they were definitely huge bumps on both.
Mm. I mean, I've been using Zwift since, pretty much since it was a beta, how many years ago that was now. And it's just like seeing how that's evolved as a program has been amazing to follow as well. I've got a Wahoo set up, like a kicker, and I just use that on my to train with. But I do most, because I live in central London, I do my like focused training indoors. So like anything that's like threshold work, sprint work, intervals, all that sort of stuff, I just do it indoors because I don't have the ability to do it outside. It takes me, you know, an hour to get to like safer roads where it's accessible to do, or I ride around the parks in London, which are very busy at the moment, so it's not really ideal. I think that the whole virtual racing, you know, the indoor training side of it's, you know, it's fantastic because it's allowing, as you said, people to keep fit and keep motivated, which has been pretty tough, you know, the last couple of months, definitely. Yeah. I think a lot of people have probably struggled a bit, a lot more than they maybe are putting on. Especially Europe, like Spain was... I was stuck in Spain when lockdown all kind of started. That was pretty scary.
Yeah, how did you get out of there? Because that was a thing. People are still stuck in foreign countries because they couldn't get out.
Yeah, I got lucky that... I was in... It's funny because when the whole corona, COVID, whatever we want to call it now, started, I was in Morocco doing a gravel race across Morocco.
Oh, yeah.
Which is called the Atlas Mountain Race. So it's like 1,700 kilometers across the Atlas Mountains. And that was February, March time. Well, February time. And that's when it kind of like was, you know, there was definitely something going on in Asia, but I think everyone in Europe anyway was kind of still a bit blasé about it and not really paying attention. Anyway, so I did that race. That was good fun. Bloody hard. Morocco is really hilly, I'll tell you that. And it's really hot in that time of year, especially for a Brit who's not used to the hot temperatures in February. I came back from Morocco. I unfortunately had a really quite serious crash out there and herniated a disc in my back, which was a disc. Yeah, I did. I'd herniated it the year before. Mm-hmm. And I crashed and it came and I caused it to come back. So I had a pretty bad crash, really scuffed up. I was riding like a steel frame out there. Mm-hmm. I managed to bend the frame, crack the wheel. Yeah, I managed to total a bike basically. I came back and I went for physio for like a couple of weeks and had my back all straightened out. I got... My coach was going out to Calpe in Spain with a couple of friends, and they were like, basically, they were all just like, look, we've got spare room if you want it, just to like be able to get some like warmth on your body and just like get riding again and motivate yourself to get riding again. You're welcome to come. So obviously I said yes, told my work that I was going quite last minute, which is maybe naughty, but oh well. I was working while I was out there. I said, I'm going to work from Spain and ride in the daytime, work in the evenings. And basically, it like shit really hit the fan. It was pretty chill in Spain for a long time. Flew out there, no problems. And then it was, I remember it being, I think it was like a Thursday or something. I'm not sure of the date, but basically I was out riding and I got back to where we were staying, and there were police cars all driving around, and effectively like on like a microphone, they're all saying, do not come outside, stay inside. You're not allowed outside. Bars are closing, restaurants are closing, stay in your apartments, all this kind of thing. And it's pretty scary. So we all like, I was then like frantically looking on my laptop for like flights to get home, because the airline I flew with cancelled all of their flights. Yeah. And then they did, then they announced they were going to do repatriation flights, which, so they weren't really saying when they were going to fly. And it was basically first come, first served. You could book on one of these flights and come home. So anyway, somehow I managed to get the last flight leaving from Alicante Airport into London before the repatriation flight started. I spent quite a lot of money doing it, but it was pretty scary. Like, it was, I was lucky. Like, some of my mates were stuck there for quite a bit longer than me. And ironically, I read in the news that, I'd say I read in the news, my dad told me that in the Isle of Man, someone had flown back from Spain, and the Isle of Man's got no cases now. They've got no cases at all. They've like completely eased up their lockdown measures. But back then, someone flew back from Spain to the Isle of Man.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they landed in the Isle of Man in Douglas Airport, they were thrown straight in prison.
Welcome home.
Yeah, welcome home, straight in prison for you, because we don't want you spreading anything, even if you don't have anything. But that'd be fair enough. they had very low cases, but they gave the all clear, complete all clear, like 2 weeks ago.
Well, that's good. I'm glad they're clear. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty mad, isn't it? But yeah, it was pretty scary. I don't think, and when I came back to the UK, it hadn't really like kicked off properly in the UK yet. And it was like a week later when the lockdown like proper came into effect in the UK, where it was like, stay at home, you know, don't leave your house unless it's for essentials, all that kind of thing. But now like things are starting to lift, like, we can go and see our loved ones, you know, you can, as long as you're keeping fair distance to them. It's definitely getting easier, but I do have concerns that there could be like a second wave, I'll be honest. But we'll see. We'll wait and see. Like, it's one of those things, isn't it? Like, you literally don't know.
No, it's true. I mean, and it's different even within Canada, we've got differences. Like, Toronto is, they've pretty much eased up the rest of the province, except Toronto, because Toronto doesn't seem to really have it totally nailed yet. So they're saying, I think this week, end of this week, they'll probably open things up a little bit. But the rest of the province is already open. I think Alberta's quite open. Most of the other provinces are open. I think Montreal is still in kind of pretty heavy lockdown, similar to Toronto. But I think that's the smart way of doing it. Doing it based on the evidence and open it up, you know, areas that can open. Just like we've managed to avoid the silliness that has come from the States. So.
Yeah,
oh my God. Continue to do that.
Yeah, let's not go too deep into that one, because I could rant about that for way too long. So one of the things that I thought was pretty cool with 4i as well is you're working with Israel Cycling Academy this year, aren't you?
Yes, yeah.
And that as a team, so I'm good friends with Alex Dowsett, who's one of the guys in that team, and he hosts quite a lot of Zwift training sessions and races and stuff. We did a 24-hour relay together, which is pretty mad. This is 2 years ago, so we did a 24-hour relay race, four riders in a team racing. It was when the clock change happens in the autumn, so it's a 25-hour day as opposed to 20. So there's organized by Red Bull, and it was worded as being the longest one day race because it's 25 hours long.
Right.
And we did this. This is when he was at Katusha still, and we did this race. And he's so strong, like so strong. People, I don't think quite realize how strong he is, but he was like quite in love with Canyon bikes, obviously, when he was at Katusha. But he's now on the Factors over at Israel Cycling Academy, and he really likes them, which is great. But he's like equally very complimentary about, he's a time trialist, so of course he's geeky as hell about power numbers. He's, you know, he's really raving about how the quality of the data from 4i, which is great, is really, really good.
That's good. When did he set the world hour record, or broke the world hour record? Was that 4 years ago now? He was the first one that really kind of slaughtered it.
Yeah, it was quite a while ago, wasn't it? 4 or 5 years ago. That was in Manchester. I went up to see it. And that was when he was at Movistar. So, yeah, 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it's a while ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Wigo took it. And then, obviously, Victor Campagnards now has it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see who goes for it next.
Yeah, I'll be interested. No one's really said anything. Well, I guess people have been really not been kind of busy doing other things or not doing other things over the last few months.
Yeah. But, Yeah, I don't know. I've not heard anything, as you say, I've not heard anything from anyone coming anywhere about it. But yeah, that's one of the things like in cycling that I really like the hour record, because it is literally, that is like as pure as it gets against the clock.
Yep.
It's 1 hour, as hard as you can go. Admittedly, like, there's a lot of advancements in aerodynamics that can help a rider, obviously, but it's just like, bugger it. Let's just go giddy-o's for an hour and see how long you can hold it on for. And like, I saw Alex when he did his one, and I went and saw Wigo's one as well. And like, it's so simple. It's just so simple. You're just riding as hard as you can for an hour. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's like, really fascinating to see. Like, it's strange. It's, I don't know, I find it quite interesting how such a simple thing could be so like absorbing as well. Anyway, the one other thing I wanted to ask you, there's two other things I wanted to ask you. First of all, like, virtual racing, are you a fan of it?
Personally, I'm not a big fan of cycling inside. I do it with a PowerWatts. It's a system. Actually, one of the guys that's I think head of sports science at ISN, he developed it, and it's a great tool. I mean, it's like you're up against, you know, 6 or 8 other people in the room, and you can see all your metrics, and it's like a trainer road workout, but with your 6 or 8 of your favorite friends. So we haven't been doing that much recently, but I'm not really into the Zwift thing or the ride in the trainer. That I like that because I find it really hard. And I'm focusing on the pain level and, you know, how am I going to hit that next interval? But I really like riding outside. So as soon as it was nice enough, I was riding outside. And we've had Toronto, it's kind of we don't really get winter. It's not that cold. So I mean, you can pretty much ride all winter. I've been trying to get outside. Although the last month and a half or a couple of months I've been with 4Eyes, I've been kind of busy. So trying to do things with the... into the whole new Zoom meetings and virtual meetings it can be really busy days.
How are you so when you get to go out, what's a normal like ride for you? Just go and ride and explore, or do you particularly like do more of a training style ride, or is it just literally just see where the road takes you?
We've got some, you know, within the city, Toronto itself has a lake on one side, and then it's bounded historical, the old city of Toronto was bounded by a river on either side. And one of those rivers that on the east, the Don, has got phenomenal mountain biking in it. Like, people don't believe that you're in the middle of the city and you've got this really, really good technical mountain biking. So you can go there and get some really good riding in. And then, you know, it's about 45 minutes for me to ride out of the city. And then you're in the country, and that's really good. And there's a fair number of good routes around that, you know, you don't have to battle the traffic on. So, I'm kind of, but when I get out there, I just tend to put in the miles. I don't know. I find that when I'm out riding, I don't really like training while riding. So I tend to train in the winter and then it all kind of dissipates over the summer. I don't get any faster. And then I need the training. I need to get back on the trainer inside to work it in the winter. So I think I'm the opposite of most people, but whatever. I just love riding. So that's the important thing.
Do you have many bears around Toronto, eh?
No, there's no bears in Canada. That's a myth. It's like there's occasional one. There's more bears in the zoo than there are. Like there's a video online of like a bear chasing people when they're riding or something. It's like, I'm sure that's Photoshopped. I don't, I've never seen a bear when I've been riding. So
It's like I rode across Australia last October. That was hard. We didn't see a kangaroo. I did with one of my mates, and we started in Perth, and we rode from Perth to Melbourne in 20 days, which is
That's a hot long ride.
Yeah, and it's also very very straight.
Yeah,
roads are very very straight there and very long, and we had a headwind almost every single day, and a headwind in Australia, like when you go across the Nullarbor Plain.
Yep.
That headwind. Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's nasty. It's a nasty headwind. It's not just like a little puppy breeze.
Nah, it's like, imagine like the wind is punching you in the face. And then you kind of get the smell of like roadkill just sort of wafting up. As you're riding along, because it's been burnt into the road because it's so warm. Yeah, that's pretty grim. But we didn't see a kangaroo for I think the first week, the first like 7 days, and we were just like, we literally were like kangaroos don't exist. It's a lie. It's a myth in Australia. There's no such thing as a kangaroo. And then anyway, like it was the day we rode along the longest, straightest road in the southern hemisphere. It's like 130 miles long, I think it was, something like that. Yeah, but it's so long that your mind can't like understand the length of it, so it just, and it looks like it goes up and you just can't, it's really hard to get your head around. Anyway, the day after that, we, and that whole, I think that total day was like, it was about 240 kilometers, whatever that, so probably it was 50, 60 miles, something like that. The day after that, anyway, we ended up riding, I think it was a 300 and something K day. And we were riding quite late into the night and it started raining. And then all of a sudden, like, because it was getting dark and it was raining, there was literally probably about 40 kangaroos just sitting in the road. And they go onto the road at night because it's cooler and because the water obviously stays on the surface of the road. So They lick the water on the road. But there was literally 40 of them and it was pitch black. And we were just like, shit, they do exist then. They are real animals. But I am determined that koalas are not real because I didn't see a koala.
Oh, well, you got to go back and find them again because my father's side of the family's Australian. So my sister lives over there now. And yeah, there's some great spots to go to actually see all these, you know, mythical Australian creatures. And that's pretty cool. You definitely got to go back.
Everything in Australia is determined to kill you somehow, though. Like magpies. Freaking magpies.
Oh, yeah, those are nasty, man. You're riding around. I've been just like here we have these red-winged blackbirds that come and beak you in the head.
Yeah.
Those magpies, I don't know what. It's like a diving, you know, dive bomber from 500 feet up. Like when they hit in the head, it's like they knock you off the freaking bike almost.
Yep. Like you can hear them. Like you just hear, you first of all, you hear like this whoosh whoosh from the wings.
Yeah.
And you look up and you're like, what was that? Where's it come from? And then you normally hear them like crowing. And then you just hear this, you just feel this dunk on your head.
Yeah.
and you literally, it happened probably couple of times, it happened probably three or four times, and you just start sprinting to get away from these birds as quick as you can. And like eventually they get bored, but they're actually bastards. Like they're horrible birds. They're really aggressive. But yeah, we that was a tough trip, that one was. You know, magpies, snakes, all of that, everything was trying to get us. Anyway, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent. One thing I always ask at the end of podcasts, and I don't know if you know this or not, is I always ask people for 5 life tips or hacks. And the reason why I ask 5 is because everyone's like, oh, 1 or 2 is kind of easy. If you ask for 5, it gets quite tricky. But they could be anything. They could be literally anything. So, for example, I've had cooking tips. I've had how to pump up a tire tips. I've had really like in-depth, like almost like meaning of life tips. I'm going to let you try and think of 5.
Oh man, I'll be there. Well, I'm an innovation guy, so that's the easy ones to nail right off the top. Yeah. So when I joined Pawn, or when Pawn bought Cervello, and yeah. They said, okay, like you guys seem to understand innovation pretty well, but figure out how to transfer that and how to educate everyone else and all the other brands. And they gave me some time to kind of really reflect on that and kind of review it. And because it's like, you know, when you try and it's easy to when you're doing it. Like Gerard and I, we just thought the same way and we just built a company. That's what we did. But when you try and actually roll it out for other people, it's a lot more difficult because what did we do right? What do we do wrong? I'm sure there's quite a few of those. And so so one of the first things was to try and figure out what the heck we were talking about, because you talked about innovation to everyone and they all have a different idea of what you're talking about. So the best definition of innovation I've ever found was meaningful uniqueness. And because, you know, it's like it's a combination of something that's advanced and something that's something that would improve your lot in life. But it's not always just a rational kind of, yes, I can measure that improvement. I'm faster using this thing. It's like, there's also the emotional aspect. Like, that's just really cool. I got to have that. Anyways, if you think about it, meaningful uniqueness takes it all into account. And you can easily measure that. You just ask people 2 questions. Have you seen that before? That's uniqueness. And would you buy that? That's meaningful. And it's super easy. When you understand that, then you can really understand how to innovate. I think, what else? So what's number one? I think from a standpoint, I've always been pretty lucky in what I've done. As I put myself through school, but it was a tremendous learning opportunity. I worked part-time at was a company that was, we built ships. So it was actually owned by Vickers when I joined there. But I think that the key thing is like people that are just getting kind of graduating or trying to figure out what they're doing in university is like, you should pick and look and understand what the market is. Like a fine arts degree, maybe super fun. And I would encourage you to do that, but it's probably not going to get you a job. So, but your whole life shouldn't be built around, oh, I got to get a job that pays well. It's like, no, your life should be built around, what do I really like to do? And that's when you'll make a meaningful difference to people. If you're passionate about it, you're going to make that job so much more than just your job. You're going to have a meaningful difference to other people's lives. So I'm big on finding what motivates you, finding what you like, and you'll find a way to make a job out of it and a career out of it.
Nice. I'm prime person for that. I nearly studied fine art. I actually delved in fashion for a bit, but then I decided to study architecture, worked in architecture, realized I didn't enjoy it, and then started working in the cycling industry because it's what I love doing.
That's good. I mean, yeah, the cycling industry is crazy, and people that work in it are crazy. You don't make as much money as you would elsewhere, but it's fun. It really is fun.
And you don't go into making money. You go into it because you enjoy it and because it's fun. That's the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think the thing is too, is if you're not having fun, it's time to reassess where you should be going. So yeah, really? Stop and sit back and look at it and figure out what you want to do. What else? I can't really think of much. I mean, I found that, you know, I have a very, well, one of the things that you look for in innovation and people always, there's a great video. People should look at this one. It's really old school. Like it's from like the 80s. You go to Google ABC News, IDEO shopping cart. IDEO being that big, probably the most well-known innovation company, IDEO. It's California, Santa Cruz based company. And they design a shopping cart and they go through the whole design process of how they would design a shopping cart. Anyways, that's a great clue for anyone that wants to get an innovation is how to do it. Like everything that I've been teaching and learned has come from, not from there. I mean, the best place to learn it and make it teachable is this company called Eureka Ranch, because they really focus on teaching you to teach others. But that shopping cart video is brilliant. And one of the things you'll find is that diversity is a big thing they talk about. And it's like, so you're designing a shopping cart. Who do you want? Well, you want an engineer. You want a marketing person. You want an ethnographer. You want a medical doctor. You want all these diverse group of people that you know, just bring different perspectives to things. So diversity is a phenomenal tool to have when you're doing innovation. The neat thing is diversity is also your diversity of your experience. So, you know, everything you've done in life just adds to your value and your enjoyment in life. So go out and try something new, go and travel. All that adds to your enjoyment of life and your diversity, and it brings to what you can add to your job and to your life. So go out and do crazy stuff and do it all the time and try new things. It's that adds to your enjoyment and adds to your value in life. So, and I found that I find that actually, because it sounds like you have a, kind of a design background. Both Gerard and I, we found that we started because of our mutual love of bikes, but we started finding that, you know, we were both into design and we were both into, you know, different aspects of design. We were both into architecture, you know, and we found out some kind of quirky things, like we both did our house interior design. And without knowing it, we actually picked the same materials for like the same slabs of marble from this one place in Italy, slightly different finishes, but we picked the same look. And it's like, ooh, that's kind of weird that we're thinking that much alike. But I mean, I think design, people that are into design, they're into all sorts of design. So just because you like fashion means you probably like, you know, architecture. So, and you'll probably like product design. So I think
it's so intertwined, isn't it, at the end of the day? Like the crossovers are so that, you know, there's, I'm a big, I'm a bit massive fan of Le Corbusier. And his book that he wrote, which is like about the modern man and all about like human geometry and understanding the proportions of a person and how that relates to space. That was like my Bible in design. And it ties in very well to product, fashion, architecture, interior, motion graphics, graphic design. It all ties in. Like the crossovers between them are, you know, it's incomparable. There's so much that does cross over and tie into it. And like another one for me was Mies van der Rohe. I loved what Mies van der Rohe did, like with the Barcelona Pavilion. Like to me, that's still one of the most iconic projects like ever. And it's so simple. It's just planes and slabs, but it's all down to the proportions of it and the choice of marble and material that's used in it. Like it's bang perfect. Like it's just spot on.
Yeah.
Absolutely spot on. And I'm obsessed with marble. I'm obsessed with it. Like, it's just like a product that is generated from millions and millions of years just from like heat and pressure, basically. The same with crystals.
Yeah.
And it creates something so stunning.
Yeah, and so many different versions of it and different types of it. It's incredible.
Yeah. And it all, you know, it's just a metamorphic rock that's carbonite materials. It's just basically pushed together in different parts of the world, and that's how you get the colors, the textures. Yeah, I'm obsessed with it. I'm proper obsessed with marble. And it was when I worked in architecture, like, it wasn't really a very popular, like, in sort of, I guess, not very in trend material.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculously expensive on some of the projects. Like you think, like, if it was like a reception desk, a marble slab for a reception desk could be a hell of a lot of money if it's a big, thick, chunky thing. So you try to look at ways of like creating almost like synthetic marbles, and, you know, looked at like Corian and Hymax materials and tried to work out what would kind of work in those senses. But realistically, nothing. And like also trying to find a way of like economically sort of sourcing it as well, being conscious of like marble is only really sort of, you know, the best stuff is from Italy, really, and it's really expensive, and it's mined for a lot of money in maybe not the best locations where it should be mined. So, like, we like looked at all these different other options, but like, it's just a beautiful material, and it's something that I, you know, it's been. I actually did like a as part of like Zero Lemon, the podcast. I started it as a way for me to just design things for fun, just out of like, oh, I fancy doing this. I'm going to design this. And then if anyone wants to buy one, you can buy one. But that's it. It's just literally done for the fun of it. So I did, I've actually just done like a marble jersey.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on the website. Actually, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. It's taken, I'll tell you what, drawing marble veins takes a long time.
But, that's cool. We just finished a house here that we've, designed and constructed here in Toronto. So I'll send you some photos of that and just the different materials we used. Some of it definitely. Italian and some of it kind of 100-mile solution. So
nice. For me, I still dabble in a bit of architecture and design work, but I just do it for fun now. Like, take off the shackles and don't have to be restrained by drawing schedules, for example.
Yeah.
Or electrical schedules or that kind of stuff. The stuff which is really dull. The stuff that you go into like architecture not really wanting to do. Anyway, sorry, I've gone off on a tangent. I'm saying that you have two more to go.
I was hoping to forget it. I was like, I got away with it. He only did three. Oh man, what else can I possibly think of?
Go on, your best cooking tip. Go for that.
My best cooking tip? You guys, I love food. I'm a real foodie. But this is the complete other end of the spectrum. Kraft dinner is freaking brilliant. There you go. There's number four.
Okay. Yeah, nice. One more. I love the last ones because it gets to this point where people are like, shit. Design some of the best bikes in the world, can't come up with five tips.
Well, giving you some design things, that's kind of boring. We've been there, done that. What else is there to do? What else do I really? I also do some motor racing. So I started off doing Formula Ford. Did some work in Formula Atlantic, and then kind of over the years kind of got into Porsches. They're a little safer. But once in your life, you've got to take a drive on a racetrack in a race car. It's unbelievable. Like, that's, you know, it's one of those experience things. It's like, you know, every time you go to an amusement park after that, and you get on a roller coaster, you go, yeah, ho hum. What's this? This is boring. It's like on a race car on a track when it's sliding sideways at, you know, 120 miles an hour, and you're setting yourself up, and it's like it becomes a zen experience when you get that car dancing. It's unbelievable how it feels when it's like everything's sliding and you're just touching it a little bit, and you can steer with two fingers and your throttle, and it's so subtle differences, and it sets the car up, and then it hooks up, and then it rockets down the straight. And you can just feel it. It's a zen moment as you get that thing moving as it goes. And it takes a lot of work. You don't get that all the time. And that's why it's so interesting and so captivating. It's just like it never comes together, or it rarely comes together. When it comes together, it's utter sheer joy.
So. See that I've done that around Brown's Hatch, which is a local race. I say local, it was quite well known motorbike and F1 a long time ago race circuit in the UK. But I've gone around the TT circuit with my dad in a car. And my dad's like talked me through the lines and how you'd rate it. And this podcast is going weirdly full circle, which is kind of good. So the one that always sticks out for me, like I've gone round it with him when the roads have been, because like if you're racing, you basically had a pass that you could go on the circuit during race days when there was no racing on. So we went round it in his car. He's got like an old school Audi 80 that he loves. He loves this car, but he's a mechanic as well. So he's tuned it up to high heaven. It's in amazing condition. And he drove it and he was talking me through the race line of the TT circuit. And the one that I always remember is you go through the start finish line and you go down. It's called Bray Hill. And on Bray Hill, on the left-hand side, the road like slightly cambers to the right. And basically on the left-hand side, there's a hedge that has a hole cut out in it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in the races, in that hole is an old man called Bobby. And my dad was like, what you do when you're racing is you are going at 120, 130 miles an hour and you are aiming for Bobby. And the only point that you pull away is when you think, shit, I'm going to crash. And he's like, that's the fastest line down Bray Hill, is you aim for Bobby until you think you're going to die. And I was just like, cool. Yeah. So yeah, it's just that's the one that always sticks in my head from the whole lap of the island is just that one, which is right at the bloody start. Aim for Bobby.
Yeah, those blind corners are super fun because you got to pick something else to look at. You can't see the corner. You just go, I'm going to aim for that tree and I'm going to hope that everything else is on the other side that's supposed to be there and no one else is blocking it.
Yeah, there's another one on the island, which is like a corner that has like three kinks in it, like four kinks in it. So the first, and on each of the kinks, there's a tree. And on each tree has like 1, 2, 3 exclamation mark painted on them. So it's like first kink, second kink, fourth kink. And for the fourth kink with the exclamation mark, it's like straighten up because otherwise you're going to crash. But it's like things like that. That side of it's fascinating. Like, as I say, I did Brown's Hatch. I did a Lamborghini and I was just like, I mean, yeah, mind blowing. That is a damn good tip. Like it's just the power of it all. And I mean, by no means am I a car racer or anything like that. I just went around it really hard and ragged a Lamborghini around the race circuit. Didn't really know what I was doing, but it felt fun.
We're lucky. Just outside of town here, we have Mossport, which is now Canadian Tire Motorsports Park. But it was the site of the Canadian Formula One Grand Prix for many years. And and it's a really, there's some amazingly difficult turns on that and dangerous turns. So it's had its fair share of incidents. But Hurley Haywood, the famous Porsche racer, there's a new movie about him and his life. It's really interesting. Actually, it's good. I think you can get it on YouTube it's available anyways. It's online. And he launched it. Yeah. He was at the movie. We had like a rented the movie theater and he was there for it. And he said, Mossport, two of the trickiest corners I've ever been on and his favorite racetrack. So we're spoiled here. Like you guys are, we have way more race courses in the UK. But we've got some nice ones as well. I should just come and do a tour of the racetracks of the UK.
Yeah. I've actually done a few bike races around a couple of them. I've done, I've done a 24-hour race around Brands Hatch, and then I've done a team time trial around Silverstone. That was fun. And then I've done a 24-hour race around the Le Mans circuit as well.
Oh, yeah. That'd be cool.
Oh, man. That's the best circuit. On a push bike, that's the best circuit I've ever ridden on, because every single, you can proper lean into the corners and you can pedal every single one. Like, you're not going to get any toe overlap or anything. You're not going to have a pedal strike every single corner. So like the lap speeds, you're doing like on a road bike, comfortably doing 30 miles an hour.
Wow. Like,
that's pretty cool. So quick. Yeah. It was amazing. Like, it was probably one of the race circuits that I've cycled on. Is the best one, because like Silverstone's really exposed, so it's always really windy. Brands Hatch has got a massive hill in it, but then the Le Mans circuit is pretty flat. Like, you can ride the whole thing in your big ring on the front. But yeah, that was pretty awesome.
You got to do, there's a 24-hour race, like a bike 24-hour race at the Nürburgring. That was super fun. Did that a few years ago.
I've seen one. I really want to do it.
Yeah, because it's like, it's in the middle of the night. It's such a long circuit, right? It's the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And you've learned the course already, so you can go pretty quick, but it's so quiet. Yeah. And you can just see, you know, dots in the feet, in the, you know, going up. Because it doesn't look like in a race car, it doesn't look that steep. On your bike, it's actually pretty steep sections of it. So, like, you're grinding up those hills. It's a good workout. And but you can just see these, it's all quiet, and you see these dots of the red taillights and people in front of you. It's really neat.
That was what, because like the Le Mans circuit's completely lit, so you didn't even have to, they said you had to have lights on, but you didn't need them, to be honest with you. But like, it's similar at Brands Hatch, because Brands Hatch has got one hill in it, I can't remember what it's called, Druids, and that's like it's the same thing. You just see these dots going up in front of you, and you're thinking, shit, that's high, because it's quite steep. And then it basically like switches around on itself on like a full on hairpin, and then drops all the way back down again. My sink is making some crazy noises. You could probably hear that.
Oh, I can actually.
The other one that I do like 24-hour TTs, and I've done the national champs three times now here in the UK. It's weird that we have a national champs for 24-hour TTs, but I've done it three times. I've come like top 10 every single time. And like your target distance is 500 miles, basically. That's what you aim for. And it's a similar thing. Like, it's open roads, but they're like generally very flat and very straight. And whenever I've raced it, I just look for the rear light and just chase down the rear lights. That was my tactic always in the race. It's like, there's a red dot, I'm going to get that red dot. There's the next red dot, I'm going to get that red dot. Just carry on.
That's cool.
Yeah. They're hard. They're really hard. Like 24 hours on a time trial bike.
Yeah. You know, I'm impressed. You got me beat there.
Well, we should just all go and do the Nürburgring one. Let's have a race at the Nürburgring. I mean, that'd be hilarious.
Yeah, it was a good time. So just got to get, you can get, I guess you can have any size of team you want, but, I think there was one person that did a solo when we were there, but we had, I think, six or eight. So it was, you got three turns, and you got plenty of sleep, so it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, it's been on my list, that one. That's been for a while. Anyway, I could literally talk to you all day, but I do appreciate that it's what, lunchtime there? 2 o'clock, 1 o'clock?
Yeah, it's 2:30, yep.
2:30, yeah. I appreciate you probably haven't had any lunch. So for me, like, I have to say a seriously massive thank you to you, because like, this is, as a fan of cycling and engineering and design, like, this is mega for me. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Phil. Thanks so much for taking like an hour and a half out of your day to talk rubbish with me about bikes and other things.
Well, thanks very much. I really enjoyed it as well. So we'll keep in touch.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, that's it. That's a wrap. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers. Mm-hmm.